Welcome everyone to Sir Malachi's Menagerie of History. This is episode 15, and we will be bringing you the continuing autobiography of Abraham Lincoln, written by Henry Ketchum, with parts 7 and 8, and we are live at 9:30 p.m. on Friday, May 21st, 2010. And I hope all of you had a great day today. Let's get started at part 7.
Chapter 23, Lincoln, His Own President. Had the question been asked early in 1861, who will be the real force of the Republican administration, almost every unprejudiced observer would have answered promptly, Seward. He was a man of unusual intellectual powers, of the best education, and of the finest culture. In regard to the moral aspect of politics, he was on the right side. He had a career of brilliant success extending over 30 years of practical experience. He had been governor of the Empire State and one of the leading members of the United States Senate. He was the most accomplished diplomatist of the day. In marked contrast was the president-elect. He had, in his encounters with Douglas, shown himself a master of debate. But his actual experience of administration was practically nil. He had served a few years in a frontier legislature and one term in the lower house of Congress. Only this and nothing more. His record as representative may be summarized as follows. One comic speech on General Cass. One set of humorous resolutions known as the Spot Resolutions. One bill in reference to slavery in the District of Columbia, which bill failed to pass. There was thus no comparison between the careers of the two men. Seward's friends and Seward himself assumed as a self-evident truth that where Seward sits is the head of the table. Lincoln did not assent to this proposition. He considered himself president and head of the cabinet. How the matter came out will appear later in the chapter. The selection of a cabinet was a difficult and delicate task. It must be remembered that Lincoln confronted a solid South backed by a divided North. It has already been said that in 15 states he received not a single electoral vote, and in 10 of these not a single popular vote. That was the solid South. The divided condition of the North may be inferred from the following letter written by ex-President Franklin Pierce to Jefferson Davis under date of January 6, 1860. If through the madness of Northern abolitionists that dire calamity, the disruption of the Union, must come, the fighting will not be along Mason and Dixon's line merely. It will be within our own borders, our own streets, between the two classes of citizens to whom I have referred. Those who defy law and scout constitutional obligation will, if we ever reach the arbitrament of arms, find occupation enough at home. It is plain that unless Lincoln could, in a large measure, unite the various classes of the North, his utter failure would be a foregone conclusion. He saw this with perfect clearness. His first move was in the selection of his cabinet. These selections were taken not only from the various geographical divisions of the country, but also from the diverse political divisions of the party. It was not his purpose to have the secretary simply echoes of himself, but able and representative men of various types of political opinion. At the outset, this did not meet the approval of his friends. Later, its wisdom was apparent. In the more than 100 years of cabinets in the history of the United States, there has never been an abler or a purer cabinet than this. As guesses, more or less accurate, were made as to what the cabinet would be, many leading citizens felt called on to labor with the president and show him the error of his ways. As late as March 2nd, there was an outbreak against Chase. A self-appointed committee, large in numbers and respectable in position, called on Lincoln to protest vigorously. He heard them with undivided attention. When they were through, he replied. In a voice of sorrow and disappointment, he said in substance, I had written out my choice and selection of members for the cabinet after most careful and deliberate consideration. And now you are here to tell me I must break the slate and begin the thing all over again. I don't like your list as well as mine. I had hoped to have Mr. Seward as Secretary of State and Mr. Chase as Secretary of the Treasury. But of course I can't expect to have things just as I want them. This being the case, gentlemen, how would it do for us to agree to a change like this? To appoint Mr. Chase Secretary of the Treasury and offer the State Department to Mr. Dayton of New Jersey. Mr. Dayton is an old Whig like Mr. Seward and myself. Besides, he is from New Jersey, which is next door to New York. Then Mr. Seward can go to England, where his genius will find wonderful scope in keeping Europe straight about our troubles. The committee were astounded. They saw their mistake in meddling in matters they did not understand. They were glad enough to back out of the awkward situation. Mr. Lincoln took that trick. The names sent on March 5th were, for Secretary of State, William H. Seward of New York. For Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon P. Chase of Ohio. For Secretary of War, Simon Cameron of Pennsylvania. For Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles of Connecticut. For Secretary of the Interior, Caleb B. Smith of Indiana. For Attorney General, Edward Bates of Missouri. For Postmaster General, Montgomery Blair of Maryland. All these names were confirmed by the Senate the next day, March 6th. Of the variety of the selection, he said, I need them all. They enjoy the confidence of their several states and sections, and they will strengthen the administration. The times are too grave and perilous for ambitious schemes and rivalries. To all who were associated with him in the government, he said, let us forget ourselves and join hands like brothers to save the Republic. If we succeed, there will be glory enough for all. He playfully spoke of this cabinet as his happy family. The only one who withdrew early from this number was Cameron. He was accused of various forms of corruption, especially of giving fat government contracts to his friends. Whether these charges were true or not, we cannot say. But in the following January, he resigned and was succeeded by Edwin M. Stanton, a lifelong Democrat, one who had accepted office under Buchanan. Probably no person was more amazed at this choice than Stanton himself, but he patriotically accepted the call of duty. With unspeakable loyalty and devotion, he served his chief and his country to the end. As has already been indicated, Seward cheerfully assumed that he was the government, while Lincoln's duties were to consist largely in signing such papers as he instructed him to sign. As difficulties grew fast and thick, he wrote home, these cares fall chiefly on me. Mr. Welles wrote that confidence and mutual frankness existed among all the members of the cabinet, with the exception of Mr. Seward, who had or affected a mysterious knowledge which he was not prepared to impart. He went so far as to meddle with the affairs of his associates. He did not entirely approve of the cabinet meetings, and served notice that he would attend only upon special summons of the President. This condition reached its climax on the first day of April, an appropriate date. Seward addressed on that day a document entitled, Some Thoughts for the President's Consideration, April 1, 1861. Henry Wanderson said that Seward could not have spoken more explicitly and hardly more offensively if he had simply said, Mr. Lincoln, you are a failure as President, but turn over the direction of affairs exclusively to me, and all shall be well, and all be forgiven. This statement gives a fair and truthful idea of Seward's letter. It is not likely that this amazing assurance has ever been equaled in any nation by thoughts addressed by any inferior officer to his chief. The paper itself is here omitted from lack of space, but its tenor can be guessed from the character of the reply, which is given in full. Executive Mansion, April 1st, 1861. Honorable W. H. Seward. My dear sir, since parting with you, I have been considering your paper dated this day and entitled Some Thoughts for the President's Consideration. The first proposition in it is, first, we are at the end of a month's administration and yet without a policy either domestic or foreign. At the beginning of that month in the inaugural, I said the power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the duties and impost. This had your distinct approval at the time, and taken in connection with the order I immediately gave General Scott, directing him to employ every means in his power to strengthen and hold the forts, comprises the exact domestic policy you now urge, with the single exception that it does not propose to abandon Fort Sumter. Again, I do not perceive how the reinforcement of Fort Sumter would be done on a slavery or party issue, while that of Fort Pickens would be on a more national and patriotic one. The news received yesterday in regard to Santo Domingo certainly brings a new item within the range of our foreign policy. But up to that time, we have been preparing circulars and instructions to ministers and the like, all in perfect harmony, without even a suggestion that we had no foreign policy. Upon your closing proposition that whatever policy we adopt, there must be an energetic prosecution of it, for this purpose it must be somebody's business to pursue or direct it incessantly. Either the President must do it himself and be all the while active in it, or delve it on some member of his cabinet. Once adopted, debates on it must end, and all agree and abide. I remark that if this must be done, I must do it. When a general line of policy is adopted, I apprehend there is no danger of its being changed without good reason or continuing to be a subject of unnecessary debate. Still, upon points arising in its progress, I wish and suppose I am entitled to have the advice of all the cabinet. Your obedient servant, A. Lincoln. The courtesy, the convincing logic, the spirit of forbearance shown in this letter were characteristic of the man at the helm. It need hardly be said that Seward never again tried the experiment of patronizing his chief. He saw a great light. He suddenly realized that these cares did not fall chiefly on him. So far as is known, neither gentleman ever made any reference to this correspondence. The result was worthwhile. It bound Seward to his president with hoops of steel. For four long, weary, trying years, he served his chief with a loyal devotion which did credit to both men. Thus the hallucination that he was premier was forever dispelled. The public man wrote, "There could be no doubt of it any longer. This man from Illinois is not in the hands of Mr. Seward." There was surely no doubt of it. Lincoln was president. In the councils, the place where Lincoln sat was the head of the table. Seward was his secretary, and a good secretary he was, as well as a true man. Chapter 24. Fort Sumter. The events connected with the fall of Sumter were so dramatic that that name is in memory linked with and stands for the opening of the war. The fort was not a large military structure. The number of men defending it was not great. But the events connected with it were great. It stood as the representative of great principles and facts. The firing on it marked an epoch in the same sense as Caesar's crossing the Rubicon. It is virtually connected with events that precede and follow. Wendell Phillips says that when Charles Sumner entered the Senate, free speech could hardly be said to exist there. To him, as much as to any man, was due the breaking of the chain that fettered free speech. On all important subjects, he spoke his mind eloquently and in words that were not ambiguous. In August 1852, he made a speech. The more accurate phrase would be, he delivered an oration, under the title, Freedom National, Slavery Sectional. It may be easily guessed that this highly incensed the slave power, and the fire-eaters never outgrew their hatred of the Massachusetts senator. In May 1856, he delivered an exoriating address upon the crime against Kansas. This greatly angered the Southern congressman. After the Senate had adjourned, Sumner was seated at his desk writing. Preston S. Brooks of South Carolina approached from the rear and with a heavy cane began to beat Sumner on the head. He was not only defenseless, but though a powerful man in body, was to a certain extent held down by his desk, and it was only as he wrenched the desk from the floor that he was able to rise. The beating had been terrible, and Sumner suffered from it, often with the most excruciating pains, until the day of his death. This ruffian attack was by a large portion of the North looked on as an exhibition of Southern chivalry, so-called, and not entirely without reason, as the sequel showed. Congress censured Brooks by a divided vote. He resigned but was re-elected by his constituents with great enthusiasm. Thus his act was by them adopted as representative of their spirit and temper. This was his vindication. South Carolina was the first state to secede, and since Fort Sumter commanded Charleston Harbor, it instantly became the focus of national interest. The Secretary of War, Floyd, had so dispersed the little army of the United States that it was impossible to command the few hundred men necessary adequately to garrison the United States forts. As matters in and about Charleston grew threatening, Major Anderson, who was in command of the twin forts Moultrie and Sumter, decided to abandon the former and do his utmost to defend the latter. The removal was successfully accomplished in the night, and when the fact was discovered, it was greeted by South Carolinians with a howl of baffled wrath. Buchanan had endeavored to send provisions. The steamer Star of the West had gone there for that purpose, but had been fired on by South Carolinians and forced to abandon the attempt. When Lincoln took the government at Washington, it may well be believed that he found matters in a condition decidedly chaotic. His task was many-sided, a greater task than that of Washington, as he had justly said. First, of the 15 slave states, 7 had seceded. It was his purpose to hold the remaining 8, or as many of them as possible. Of this number, Delaware and Maryland could have been held by force. Kentucky and Missouri, though slave states, remained in the Union. The Union Party in Tennessee, under the lead of Andrew Johnson, made a strong fight against secession, but failed to prevent the ordinance. The next task of Lincoln was to unite the North as far as possible. The difficulty of doing this has already been set forth. On the other hand, there was in the North a sentiment that had been overlooked. It was devotion to the flag. Benjamin F. Butler, though an ardent Democrat, had cautioned his Southern brethren that while they might count on a large pro-slavery vote in the North, war was a different matter. The moment you fire on the flag, he said, you unite the North, and if war comes, slavery goes. Not the least task of the President was in dealing with foreign nations. The sympathies of these, especially England and France, were ardently with the South. They would eagerly grasp at the slightest excuse for acknowledging the Southern Confederacy as an independent nation. It was a delicate and difficult matter so to guide affairs that the desired excuse for this could not be found. The tactics of Southerners were exceedingly exasperating. They kept envoys in Washington to treat with the government. Of course, these were not officially received. Lincoln sent them a copy of his inaugural address as containing a sufficient answer to their questions. But they stayed on, trying to spy out the secrets of the government, trying to get some sort of a pledge of conciliation from the administration, or, what would equally serve the purpose, to exasperate the administration into some unguarded word or act. Their attempts were a flat failure. Lincoln held steadily to the two promises of his inaugural. First, that he would hold the United States forts, and second, that he would not be the aggressor. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I have the most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it. To this plan he adhered. If there was to be war, it must be begun by the enemies of the country, and the government would patiently bear outrages rather than do a thing which could be tortured into an appearance of invading the South or being an aggressor of any sort. Meanwhile, Major Anderson was beleaguered in Fort Sumter. He had a handful of men, 76 combatants, and 128 all told. He had insufficient ammunition and was nearly out of provisions. Lincoln at last concluded to send bread to Sumter, surely not a hostile act. Owing to complications which he inherited from Buchanan's administration, he had given to Governor Pickens of South Carolina a promise that he would not attempt to relieve Sumter without first giving him notice. He now sent him notice that there would be an attempt to provision Sumter peaceably, if possible, or otherwise by force. All this while the Southerners were busy perfecting their fortifications, which were now overwhelmingly better, both in number and in completeness of appointment, than the one fort held by the United States that rightfully controlled the entire harbor. General Beauregard was in command of the military forces. he sent to Major Anderson a summons to surrender. The latter replied that if he received from Washington no further direction, and if he was not succored by the 15th of the month, April, he would surrender on honorable terms. It is characteristic of the Southern general that he intercepted Major Anderson's mail before notifying him of the hostilities. It is characteristic of Lincoln that he sent notice to Governor Pickens of the intended provisions of the fort. On Friday, April 12, 1861, at 3:30 a.m., General Beauregard gave notice to Major Anderson that he would open fire on Fort Sumter in 1 hour. Promptly at the minute, the first gun was fired, and the war had begun. Batteries from various points poured shot and shell into Sumter until nightfall caused a respite. The little garrison sat up half the night after the attack, as they had done the preceding night, and with their six needles, all they had, made cartridges out of old blankets, old clothing, and whatever else they could lay hands on. These 128 men made all the defense that could be made under the circumstances. The next day, the officers' quarters were set on fire, either by an exploding shell or by hot shot. The men fought the flames gallantly, but the wind was unfavorable. Then the water tanks were destroyed. As the flames approached the magazine, the powder had to be removed. As the flames approached the places where the powder was newly stored, it had to be thrown into the sea to prevent explosion. In the meantime, the Stars and Stripes were floating gloriously. The flagpole had been struck 7 times on Friday. It was struck 3 times the next day. The 10th shot did the work. The pole broke and the flag fell to the ground at 1 o'clock Saturday afternoon. An officer and some men seized the flag, rigged up a jury mast on the parapet, and soon it was flying again. But ammunition was gone, the fire was not extinguished, and there was no hope of relief. Negotiations were open, and terms of surrender were arranged by 8 o'clock that evening. The next day, Sunday, April 14th, the garrison saluted the flag as it was lowered, and then marched out, prisoners of war. Sumter had fallen. Beauregard was a military man. Lincoln was a statesman. The general got the fort. The president got nearly everything else. The war was on, and it had been begun by the South. The administration had not invaded or threatened invasion, but the South had fired on the flag. Dearly they paid for this crime. The effect of the fall of Sumter was amazing. In the South it was hailed with ecstatic delight, especially in Charleston. There was a popular demonstration at Montgomery, Alabama, the provisional seat of the Confederate government. L.P. Walker, the Confederate Secretary of War, made a speech and, among other things, said that while no man could tell where the war would end, he would prophesy that the flag which now flaunts the breeze here would float over the dome of the old Capitol at Washington before the end of May, and that it might eventually float over Faneuil Hall itself. The Confederate government raised a loan of $8 millions of dollars, and Jefferson Davis issued letters of marque to all persons who might desire to aid the South and at the same time enrich themselves by depredations upon the commerce of the United States. The effect upon the North was different. There was a perfect storm of indignation against the people who had presumed to fire on the flag. Butler's prediction proved to be nearly correct. This did unite the North in defense of the flag. Butler was a conspicuous example of this effect. Though a Breckinridge Democrat, he promptly offered his services for the defense of the country, and throughout the war he had the distinction of being hated by the South with a more cordial hatred than any other Union general. It was recollected throughout the North that Lincoln had been conciliatory to a fault towards the South. Conciliation had failed because that was not what the South wanted. They wanted war, and by them was war made. This put an end forever to all talk of concession and compromise. Douglas was one of the many whose voice called in trumpet tones to the defense of the flag. At the date of the fall of Sumter, Lincoln had been in office less than 6 weeks. In addition to routine work, to attending to extraordinary calls in great numbers, he had accomplished certain very important things. He had the loyal devotion of a cabinet noted for its ability and diversity. He had the enthusiastic confidence of the doubtful minds of the North. He had made it impossible for the European monarchies to recognize the South as a nation. So far as our country was concerned, he might ask for anything, and he would get what he asked for. These were no mean achievements. The far-seeing statesman had played for this and had won. Beauregard got the fort, but Lincoln got the game. In his own words, he took that trick. Chapter 25, The Outburst of Patriotism. The fall of Sumter caused an outburst of patriotism through the entire North, such as is not witnessed many times in a century. On Sunday morning, April 14th, it was well known that terms of surrender had been arranged. On that day, and on many succeeding Sundays, the voices from a thousand pulpits sounded with the certainty of the bugle the call to the defense of the flag. Editors echoed the call. Such newspapers as were suspected of secession tendencies were compelled to hoist the American flag. For the time, at least, enthusiasm and patriotism ran very high. Those who were decidedly in sympathy with the South remained quiet, and those who were of doubtful mind were swept along with the tide of popular feeling. The flag had been fired on. That one fact united the North. On that same evening, Senator Douglas arranged for a private interview with President Lincoln. For 2 hours, these men, rivals and antagonists of many years, were in confidential conversation. What passed between them, no man knows. But the result of the conference was quickly made public. Douglas came out of the room as determined a war Democrat as could be found between the oceans. He himself prepared a telegram which was everywhere published, declaring that he would sustain the President in defending the Constitution. Lincoln had prepared his call for 75,000 volunteer troops. Douglas thought the number should have been 200,000. So it should. And so doubtless it would, had it not been for certain iniquities of Buchanan's maladministration. There were no arms, accoutrements, clothing. Floyd had well nigh stripped the Northern arsenals. Lincoln could not begin warlike preparations on any great scale, because that was certain to precipitate the war, which he so earnestly strove to avoid. Further, the 75,000 was about 5 times the number of soldiers then in the Army of the United States. Though the number of volunteers was small, their proportion to the regular army was large. That night, Lincoln's call and Douglas's endorsement were sent over the wires. Next morning, the two documents were published in every daily paper north of Mason and Dixon's line. The call for volunteer soldiers was in the South greeted with a howl of derision. They knew how the arsenals had been stripped. They had also for years been quietly buying up arms, not only from the North, but also from various European nations. They had for many years been preparing for just this event, and now that it had come, they were fully equipped. During the first months of the war, the administration could not wisely make public how very poorly the soldiers were armed, for this would only discourage the defenders of the Union and cheer the enemy. This call for troops met with prompt response. The various governors of the northern states offered many times their quota. The first in the field was Massachusetts. This was due to the foresight of ex-Governor Banks. He had for years kept the state militia up to a high degree of efficiency. When rallied upon this, he explained that it was to defend the country against a rebellion of the slaveholders which was sure to come. The call for volunteers was published on the morning of April 15th. By 10 o'clock, the 6th Massachusetts began to rendezvous. In less than 36 hours, the regiment was ready and off for Washington. They were everywhere cheered with much enthusiasm. In New York, they were guests of the Astor House, whose patriotic proprietor would receive no compensation from the defenders of the flag. The reception in Baltimore was of a very different sort. Some ruffians of that city had planned to assassinate Lincoln in February, and now they in large numbers prepared to attack the soldiers who were hastening to the defense of the national capital. Here was the first bloodshed of the war. The casualties were 4 killed and 36 wounded. When the regiment reached Washington City, the march from the railway station was very solemn. Behind the marching soldiers followed the stretchers bearing the wounded. The dead had been left behind. Governor Andrews' dispatch to Mayor Brown, "Send them home tenderly," elicited the sympathy of millions of hearts. The mayor of Baltimore and the governor of Maryland sent a deputation to Lincoln to ask that no more troops be brought through that city. The president made no promise, but he said he was anxious to avoid all friction and would do the best he could. He added playfully that if he granted that, they would be back next day to ask that no troops be sent around Baltimore. That was exactly what occurred. The committee were back the next day, protesting against permitting any troops to cross the state of Maryland. Lincoln replied that as they couldn't march around the state, nor tunnel under it, nor fly over it, he guessed they would have to march across it. It was arranged that for the time being, the troops should be brought to Annapolis and transported thence to Washington by water. This was one of the many remarkable instances of forbearance on the part of the government. There was a great clamor on the part of the North for vengeance upon Baltimore for its crime, and a demand for sterner measures in the future. But the President was determined to show all the conciliation it was possible to show, both in this case and in 100 others. These actions bore good fruit. It secured to him the confidence of the people to a degree that could have not been foreseen. On the 22nd of July, 1861, Mr. Crittenden of Kentucky offered the following resolution. Resolved by the House of Representatives of the United States, that the present deplorable civil war has been forced upon the country by the disunionists of the southern states, now in arms against the constitutional government and in arms around the Capitol. That in this national emergency, Congress, banishing all feelings of mere passion or resentment, will recollect only its duty to the whole country. That this war is not waged on their part in any spirit of oppression, or for any purpose of conquest or subjugation, or purpose of overthrowing or interfering with the rights or established institutions of those states, but to defend and maintain the supremacy of the Constitution and to preserve the Union with all the dignity, equality, and rights of the several states unimpaired, and that as soon as these objects are accomplished, the war ought to cease. This resolution was passed with only 2 dissenting votes. Lincoln's patience, forbearance, conciliation had accomplished this marvel. Very early in the war, the question of slavery confronted the generals. In the month of May, only about 2 months after the inauguration, Generals Butler and McClellan confronted the subject, and their methods of dealing with it were as widely different as well could be. When Butler was in charge of Fortress Monroe, 3 Negroes fled to the place for refuge. They said that Colonel Mallory had set them to work upon the rebel fortifications. A flag of truce was sent in from the rebel lines demanding the return of the Negroes. Butler replied, "I shall retain the Negroes as contraband of war. You were using them upon your batteries. It is merely a question whether they shall be used for or against us." From that time, the word contraband was used in common speech to indicate an escaped slave. It was on the 26th day of the same month that McClellan issued to the slaveholders a proclamation in which are found these words: "Not only will we abstain from all interference with your slaves, but we will, on the contrary, with an iron hand, crush any attempt at insurrection on their part." It is plain that McClellan's "we" did not include his brother general at Fortress Monroe. Further comment on his attitude is reserved to a later chapter. The early victims of the war caused a deep and profound sympathy. The country was not yet used to carnage. The expectancy of a people not experienced in war was at a high tension, and these deaths, which would at any time have produced a profound impression, were emphatically impressive at that time. One of the very first martyrs of the war was Elmer E. Ellsworth. He was young, handsome, impetuous. At Chicago, he had organized among the firemen a company of Zouaves with their spectacular dress and drill. These Zouaves had been giving exhibition drills in many northern cities and aroused no little interest. One result was the formation of similar companies at various places. The fascinating Zouave drill became quite popular. In 1861, Ellsworth was employed in the office of Lincoln and Herndon in Springfield. When the president-elect journeyed to Washington, Ellsworth, to whom Lincoln was deeply attached, made one of the party. At the outbreak of hostilities, he was commissioned as colonel to raise a regiment in New York. On the south bank of the Potomac, directly opposite Washington, was Alexandria. The keeper of the mansion house in that place had run up a secession flag on the mast at the top of the hotel. This flag floated day after day in full sight of Lincoln and Ellsworth and the others. Ellsworth led an advance upon Alexandria on the evening of May 23rd. The rebels escaped. The next morning, as usual, the secession flag floated tauntingly from the mansion house. Ellsworth's blood was up, and he resolved to take down that flag and hoist the stars and stripes with his own hand. Taking with him two soldiers, he accomplished his purpose. Returning by a spiral stairway, he carried the rebel flag in his hand. The proprietor of the hotel came out from a place of concealment, placed his double-barrel shotgun nearly against Ellsworth's body, and fired. The assassin was instantly shot down by Private Brownell, but Ellsworth was dead. The rebel flag was dyed in the blood of his heart. Underneath his uniform was found a gold medal with the inscription, Non solum nobis, sed pro patria. Not for ourselves, only but for our country. The body was removed to Washington City, where it lay in state in the East Room until burial. The President, amid all the cares of that busy period, found time to sit many hours beside the body of his friend, and at the burial he appeared as chief mourner. This murder fired the Northern imagination to a degree. The picture of Ellsworth's handsome face was everywhere familiar. It is an easy guess that hundreds, not to say thousands of babies were named for him within the next few months. And to this day the name Elmer, starting from him, has not ceased to be a favorite. A little more than 2 weeks later, on the 10th of June, the first real battle of the war was fought. This was at Big Bethel, Virginia, near Fortress Monroe. The loss was not great as compared with later battles, being only 18 killed and 53 wounded. But among the killed was Major Theodore Winthrop, a young man barely 33 years of age. He was the author of several successive books and gave promise of a brilliant literary career. He was a true patriot and a gallant soldier. His death was the source of sorrow and anger to many thousands of readers of Cecil Dream. It was 2 months later that General Lyon fell at Wilson's Creek, Missouri. He had been conspicuous for his services to the country before this time. The battle was bitterly contested, and Lyon showed himself a veritable hero in personal courage and gallantry. After three wounds, he was still fighting on, leading personally a bayonet charge when he was shot for the fourth time, fell from his horse, and died immediately. It was the gallant death of a brave soldier that touches the heart and fires the imagination. These deaths, and such as these occurring at the beginning of the war, taught the country the painful truth that the cost of war is deeper than can possibly be reckoned. The dollars of money expended and the lists of numbers killed, wounded, and missing do not fully express the profound sorrow, the irreparable loss.
Thank you, everyone, for being here tonight. Before I continue on with Part 8 of The Life of Abraham Lincoln, written by Henry Kitchen, please join us on Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for the 105th edition of the Patriot Hour, where General Rachel and I try to make sense of all this nonsense. And now, Part 8.
Chapter 26, The War Here to Stay. Lincoln was a man of great sagacity. Few statesmen have had keener insight or more true and sane foresight. While cordially recognizing this, it is not necessary to claim him for infallibility. He had his disappointments. The morning after the evacuation of Fort Sumter, he issued his call for 75,000 volunteers to serve for 3 months. We have seen that one reason why the number was so small was that this was the largest number that could possibly be clothed, armed, and officered at short notice. Subsequent experience showed that the brief enlistment of 3 months was an utterly inadequate period for so serious an insurrection. did Lincoln really think the rebellion could be put down in 3 months? Why did he not save infinite trouble by calling for 5-year enlistments at the beginning? For one thing, he had at that time no legal power to call for a longer period of enlistment. Then he desired to continue the conciliatory policy as long as possible, so as to avoid alienating the undecided in both the North and the South. Had the first call been for 500,000 for 3 years, it would have looked as if he intended and desired a long and bloody war, and this would have antagonized large numbers of persons. But it is probable that neither he nor the community at large suspected the seriousness of the war. The wars in which the men then living had had experience were very slight. In comparison with what followed, they were mere skirmishes. How should they foresee that they were standing on the brink of one of the longest, the costliest, the bloodiest, and the most eventful wars of all history? Virginia was dragooned into secession. She declined to participate in the Charleston Convention. Though a slave state, the public feeling was by a decided majority in favor of remaining in the Union. But after the fall of Sumter, she was manipulated by skillful politicians, appealed to and cajoled on the side of prejudice and sectional feeling, and on April 17th passed the Ordinance of Secession. It was a blunder, and a more costly blunder she could not have made. For 4 years, her soil was the theater of a bitterly contested war, and her beautiful valleys were drenched with human blood. Back and forth, over and over again, fought the two armies, literally sweeping the face of the country with the besom of destruction. The oldest of her soldiers of legal age were 55 years of age when the war closed. The youngest were 12 years of age when the war opened. Older men and younger boys were in the war, aye, and were killed on the field of battle. As the scourge of war passed over that state from south to north, from north to south for 4 years, many an ancient and proud family was simply exterminated, root and branch. Of some of the noblest and best families, there is today not a trace and scarcely a memory. All this could not have been foreseen by these Virginians, nor by the people of the North, nor by the clear-eyed president himself. Even the most cautious and conservative thought that the war would be of brief duration. They were soon to receive a rude shock and learn that war is hell, and that this war was here to stay. This revelation came with the first great battle of the war, which was fought July 21, 1861 at Bull Run, a location not more than 25 or 30 miles from Washington. Certain disabilities of our soldiers should be borne in mind. Most of them were fresh from farm, factory, or store, and had no military training, even in the militia. A large number were just reaching the expiration of their term of enlistment and were homesick and eager to get out of the service. The generals were not accustomed to handling large bodies of men. To add to the difficulty, the officers and men were entirely unacquainted with one another. Nevertheless, most of them were ambitious to see a little of the real war before they went back to the industries of peace. They saw far more than they desired. It was supposed by the administration and its friends that one crushing blow would destroy the insurrection and that this blow was to be dealt in this coming battle. The troops went to the front as to a picnic. The people who thronged Washington, politicians, merchants, students, professional men and ladies as well, had the same eagerness to see a battle that in later days they have to witness a regatta or a game of football. The civilians, men and women, followed the army in large numbers. They saw all they looked for and more. The battle was carefully planned, and except for delay in getting started, it was fought out very much as planned. It is not the scope of this book to enter into the details of this or any battle, but this much may be said in a general way. The Confederates were all the day receiving a steady stream of fresh reinforcements. The Federals, on the other hand, had been on their feet since 2 o'clock in the morning. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, after 11 hours of activity and 5 hours of fighting in the heat of a July day in Virginia, these men were tired, thirsty, hungry, and worn out. Then came the disastrous panic and the demoralization. A large portion of the army started in a race for Washington, the civilians in the lead. The disaster was terrible, but there is nothing to be gained by magnifying it. Some of the oldest and best armies in the world have been broken into confusion quite as badly as this army of raw recruits. They did not so far lose heart that they were not able to make a gallant stand at Centralville and successfully check the pursuit of the enemy. It was said that Washington was at the mercy of the Confederates, but it is more likely that they had so felt the valor of the foe that they were unfit to pursue the retreating army. It was a hard battle on both sides. No one ever accused the Confederates of cowardice, and they surely wanted to capture Washington City. That they did not do so is ample proof that the battle was not a picnic for them. It had been boasted that one Southern man could whip five Northern men. This catchy phrase fell into disuse. It was natural and politic for the Confederates to magnify their victory. This was done without stint by Jeff Davis, who was present as a spectator. He telegraphed the following: "Night has closed upon a hard-fought field. Our forces were victorious. The enemy was routed and fled precipitably, abandoning a large amount of arms, ammunition, knapsacks, and baggage. The ground was strewed for miles with those killed, and the farmhouses and the ground around were filled with wounded. Our force was 15,000, that of the enemy estimated at 35,000. That account is sufficiently accurate, except as to figures. Jeff Davis never could be trusted in such circumstances to give figures with any approach to accuracy. Losing estimates that the Federal forces were 13,000 and the Confederates about 27,000. This is certainly nearer the truth than the boast of Jeff Davis. But a fact not less important than the numbers was that the Confederate reinforcements were fresh, while the Federal reinforcements were nearly exhausted from marching half the night before the fighting began. Although the victorious forces were effectively checked at Centralville, those who fled in absolute rout and uncontrollable panic were enough to give the occasion a lasting place in history. The citizens who had gone to see the battle had not enjoyed their trip. The soldiers who had thought that this war was a sort of picnic had learned that that foe was formidable. The administration that had expected to crush the insurrection by one decisive blow became vaguely conscious of the fact that the war was here to stay months and years. It is a curious trait of human nature that people are not willing to accept a defeat simply. The mind insists on explaining the particular causes of that specific defeat. Amusing instances of this are seen in all games, football, regattas, oratorical contests, also in elections. The defeated have a dozen reasons to explain why the favorite candidate was not elected as he should have been. This trait came out somewhat clamorously after the Battle of Bull Run. A large number of plausible explanations were urged on Mr. Lincoln, who finally brought the subject to a conclusion by the remark, "I see. We whipped the enemy and then ran away from him." The effect of the Battle of Bull Run on the South was greatly to encourage them and add to their enthusiasm. The effect on the North was to deepen their determination to save the flag, to open their eyes to the fact that the Southern power was strong, and with renewed zeal and determination they girded themselves for the conflict. But the great burden fell on Lincoln. He was disappointed that the insurrection was not and could not be crushed by one decisive blow. There was need of more time, more men, more money, more blood. These thoughts and relative duties were to him, with his peculiar temperament, a severer trial than they could have been to perhaps any other living man. He would not shirk from doing his full duty, though it was so hard. It made an old man of him. The night before he decided to send bread to Sumter, he slept not a wink. That was one of the very many nights when he did not sleep, and there were many mornings when he tasted no food. But weak, fasting, worn, aging as he was, he was always at his post of duty. The most casual observer could see the inroads which these mental cares made upon his giant body. It was about a year later than this that an old neighbor and friend, Noah Brooks of Chicago, went to Washington to live, and he has vividly described the change in the appearance of the president. In Harper's Monthly for July 1865, he writes, "Though the intellectual man had greatly grown meantime, few persons would recognize the hearty, blithesome, genial, and wirily Abraham Lincoln of earlier days in the 16th President of the United States, with his stooping figure, dull eyes, careworn face, and languid frame. The old clear laugh never came back. the even temper was sometimes disturbed, and his natural charity for all was often turned into unwanted suspicion of the motives of men whose selfishness caused him so much wear of mind. Again, the same writer said in Scribner's Monthly for February 1878, "There was in 1862 over his face an expression of sadness and a faraway look in his eyes which were utterly unlike the Lincoln of other days. I confess that I was so pained that I could almost have shed tears. By and by, when I knew him better, his face was often full of mirth and enjoyment. And even when he was pensive or gloomy, his features were lighted up very much as a clouded alabaster vase might be softly illuminated by a light within. He still used his epigram, and was still reminded of a little story when he wished to point out a moral or adorn a tale. But they were superficial indeed, who thought they saw in him only or chiefly the jester. Once when he was reproved for reading from a humorous book, he said with passionate earnestness that the humor was his safety valve. If it were not for the relief, he would die. It was true. But he lived on. Not because he wanted to live, for he would rather have died. But it was God's will, and his country needed him." Chapter 27, The Darkest Hour. There were so many dark hours in that war, and those hours were so dark that it is difficult to specify one as the darkest hour. Perhaps a dozen observers would mention a dozen different times. But Lincoln himself spoke of the complication known as the Trent Affair as the darkest hour. From his standpoint, it was surely so. It was so because he felt the ground of public confidence slipping out from under him as at no other time. The majority of the North were with him in sentiment for the most part. A goodly number were with him all the time, except this. This time, Charles Sumner, the chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, was in agreement with him, but beyond that, everybody was against him, North and South, and all Europe as well. Upon him fell the task of turning the very turbulent current of public sentiment into the channel of duty and wisdom. The facts of the affair were simple. Two men, Mason and Slidell, both ex-senators of the United States, had started with their secretaries and families to England and France as emissaries of the Confederate government. These countries had already recognized the Confederates as belligerents, and the mission of these men was to secure the recognition of the Confederate government as a nation. They succeeded in running the blockade at Charleston and put in at Havana. There they were received with much ostentation. They took passage on the British mail steamer Trent to St. Thomas, intending to take the packet thence to England. Captain Wilkes, commanding a war vessel of the United States, was in the neighborhood and learned of these proceedings and plans. He stopped the British vessel on the high seas and by force took the two men and their secretaries. They were confined in Fort Warren, Boston Harbor. This capture set the entire North ablaze with enthusiasm. Seward was in favor of it. Stanton, who a few weeks later was appointed Secretary of War, applauded the act. Wells, Secretary of the Navy, wrote a congratulatory letter upon the great public service. The people of Boston tendered a banquet to the hero of the hour. When Congress assembled about a month later, it gave him a vote of thanks. This wave of public enthusiasm swept the country from ocean to ocean. The southern sympathies of England and France had been so pronounced that this whole country seemed to unite in hilarious triumph over this capture and regard it as a slap in the face to England's pride. The fact that the complications threatened war with that nation only added fuel to the flames. The excitement ran highest among the soldiers. Camp life had become monotonous, no decisive victories had raised their courage and enthusiasm. They were tired. They were exasperated with England's policy. They wanted to fight England. The feeling upon the other side of the question ran equally high in the South, in England, and in France. As soon as the matter could receive official attention, the British minister at Washington was instructed to demand the instant release of the four men with a suitable apology. He was to wait 7 days for an answer, and if the demand was not met by that time, he was to break off diplomatic relations with the United States. This, of course, meant war. Sumner seems to have been the only other one who said, "We shall have to give them up." Lincoln, when he heard of the capture, declared that they would prove to be white elephants on our hands. we shall have to give them up, he too said. But the difficulty was to lead the excited nation to see the need of this as he saw it. He declared that we fought Great Britain for doing just what Captain Wilkes had done. If Great Britain protests against this act and demands their release, we must adhere to our principles of 1812. We must give up these prisoners. Besides, one war at a time. He again said that it was the bitterest pill he ever swallowed. But England's triumph will not last long. After this war is over, we shall call her to account for the damage she has done to us in our hour of trouble. The policy of the government with regard to this matter was not settled in the cabinet meeting until the day after Christmas. Public enthusiasm by that time had had 6 weeks in which to cool down. In that time, the sober second judgment had illuminated many minds, and the general public was ready to see and hear reason. The outline of the reply of the United States was instructed by Lincoln, but he instructed Seward to choose his own method of arguing the case. The reply was set forth in a very able and convincing paper. It reaffirmed our adhesion to the doctrine of 1812, said that Captain Wilkes had not done in an orderly way that which he did, promised the prisoners would be cheerfully set at liberty, but declined to make an apology. At this late date we are able to look somewhat behind the scenes, and we know now that the Queen and Prince Consort were very deeply concerned over the possibility of a war with us. They had only the kindest feelings for us, and just then they felt especially grateful for the many courtesies which had been shown to the Prince of Wales upon his recent visit to this country. They were glad to get through with the incident peaceably and pleasantly. Seward's reply was accepted as fully satisfactory. The English concurred, the Americans concurred, and the danger was over. There was then something of a revulsion of feeling. The feeling between our government and that of England was more cordial than before, and the same is true of the feeling between the two peoples. The South and their sympathizers were bitterly disappointed. The wise management of our president had turned one of the greatest dangers into a most valuable success. There was never again a likelihood that England would form an alliance with the Southern Confederacy. The result was most fortunate for us and unfortunate for the Southern emissaries. They were no longer heroes. They were gentlemen of eminence, but not public functionaries. They were like other travelers, nothing more. They were not received at either court. They could only linger about the back doors of the courts, where they expected to be received in triumph, and bear as best they could the studied neglect with which they were treated. The affair, so ominous at one time, became most useful in its practical result to our cause. Lord Palmerston, the British Premier, got the four prisoners, but Lincoln won the game. This is a convenient place to speak of the personal griefs of the President. From his earliest years on, he was wonderfully affected by the presence of death. Very few people have had this peculiar feeling of heartbreak with such overwhelming power. The death of his infant brother in Kentucky, the death of his mother in Indiana, impressed him and clouded his mind in a degree entirely unusual. We have seen that in Springfield the death of Anne Rutledge well nigh unseated his reason. From these he never recovered. The horror of war was that it meant death, death, death. He whose heart was tender to a fault was literally surrounded by death. The first victim of the war, Colonel Ellsworth, was a personal friend, and his murder was a personal affliction. There were others that came near to him. Colonel E.D. Baker, an old friend and neighbor of Lincoln, the man who had introduced him at his inaugural, was killed at Ball's Bluff, October 21, 1861. Baker's personal courage made him conspicuous and marked him out as a special target for the enemy's aim. While gallantly leading a charge, he fell, pierced almost simultaneously by four bullets. It fell upon Lincoln like the death of a brother. He was consumed with grief. The following February, his two boys, Willie and Tad, were taken ill. Lincoln's fondness for children was well known. This general love of children was a passion in regard to his own sons. In this sickness, he not only shared the duties of night watching with the nurse, but at frequent intervals he would slip away from callers and even from cabinet meetings to visit briefly the little sufferers. Willie died on February 20th, and for several days before his death he was delirious. His father was with him almost constantly. This is one of the few instances when he could be said to neglect public business. For a few days before and a longer period after Willie's death, he was completely dejected. Though he was a devout Christian in spirit and temper, his ideas of personal immortality were not at that time sufficiently clear to give him the sustaining help which he needed under his affliction. J.G. Holland records a pathetic scene. This was communicated to him by a lady whose name is not given. She had gone to Washington to persuade the president to have hospitals for our soldiers located in the North. He was skeptical of the plan and was slow to approve it. His hesitation was the occasion of much anxiety to her. When he finally granted the petition, she thanked him with the greatest earnestness and said she was sure he would be happy that he had done it. He sat with his face in his hands and groaned, "Happy? I shall never be happy again." Below all his play of wit and humor, there was an undercurrent of agony. So great were his kindness, gentleness, tenderness of heart, that he could not live in this cruel world, especially in the period when times were so much out of joint, without being a man of sorrows. The present writer never saw Lincoln's face but twice, once in life and once in death. Both times it seemed to him, and as he remembers it after the lapse of more than a third of a century, it still seems to him, the saddest face his eyes have ever looked upon. Chapter 28. Lincoln and Fremont. In a community like that of the United States, where free press and free speech prevail, where every native-born boy is a possible president, some undesirable results are inevitable. The successful men become egotistic, and it is a common, well-nigh universal practice for all sorts and conditions of men to speak harshly of the authorities. In the loafers on the street corners, in the illiterate that use the country store as their club, in the very halls of Congress, are heard the most unsparing criticisms and denunciations of the administration. These unwarranted comments fell thick and fast on Lincoln because he was at the post of responsibility in a critical period, a time of general unrest. Self-appointed committees of businessmen, politicians, clergymen, editors, and whatnot were continually telling him what to do and how to do it. Not a few of even the generals caught the infection. It is not possible nor desirable to tell of Lincoln's relations with many of the eminent men with whom he dealt. But a few will be selected, Fremont, McClellan, Greeley, and Grant, in order to explain some of the difficulties which were continually rising up before him, and by showing how he dealt with them to illustrate certain phases of his character. This chapter will treat of Fremont. At the outbreak of the war, he was the most conspicuous military man in the North. He had earned the gratitude of the country for distinguished services in California and was deservedly popular among Republicans for his leadership of the party in 1856. He was at the best period of his life, being 48 years of age. His abilities were marked, and he possessed in an unusual degree the soldierly quality of inspiring enthusiasm. If he could turn all his powers into the channel of military efficiency, he would be the man of the age. He had the public confidence, and he had such an opportunity as comes to few men. At the opening of the war, he was in Paris and was at once summoned home. He arrived in this country about the 1st of July and was by the president appointed Major General in the regular army. On the 3rd of July, he was assigned to the Western Department with headquarters at St. Louis. This department included the state of Illinois and extended as far west as the Rocky Mountains. At that time, the condition of affairs in Missouri was distressful and extremely threatening. The state of Missouri covers a very large territory, 69,415 square miles, and it was imperfectly provided with railroads and other means of communication. Private bands of marauders and plunderers were numerous and did a great amount of damage among law-abiding citizens. There were also several insurgent armies of no mean dimensions threatening the state from the southwest. There were good soldiers and officers there in defense of the Union, but they were untried, insufficiently armed and accoutred, unprovided with means of transportation, and, above all, they were in need of a commanding general of sagacity, daring, and personal resources. Fremont seemed to be just the man for the important post at that critical hour. Generals Lyon, Hunter, and others were sore pressed in Missouri. They needed the presence of their commander, and they needed him at once. Fremont was ordered to proceed to his post immediately. This order he did not obey. He could never brook authority, and he was not in the habit of rendering good reasons for his acts of disobedience. Though he was aware that the need of his presence was urgent, he dallied about Washington a long time, and then proceeded west with leisure, arriving in St. Louis nearly 3 weeks later than he should have done. These 3 weeks were, under the circumstances, time enough for an incalculable amount of damage, enough to make all the difference between success and failure. It was long enough to ensure the death on August 10th of that brave soldier, General Lyon, and long enough to account for many other disasters. One of the most annoying things with which the subordinate generals had to contend was that about this time the term of service of the men who had enlisted for 3 months was beginning to expire. Many of these re-enlisted, and many did not. It was not possible to plan an expedition of any sort when it was probable that a large portion of the command would be out of service before it was completed. There was need of a master hand at organizing and inspiring loyalty. Though Fremont had so unaccountably delayed, yet when he came he was received with confidence and enthusiasm. Lincoln gave to him, as he did to all his generals, very nearly a carte blanche. His instructions were general, and the commander was left to work out the details in his own way. All that he required was that something should be done successfully in the prosecution of the war. The country was not a judge of military plans. It was a judge of military success and failure. They expected, and they had a right to expect, that Fremont should do something more than keep up a dress parade. Lincoln laid on him this responsibility in perfect confidence. The first thing Fremont accomplished in Missouri was to quarrel with his best friends, the Blair family. This is important chiefly as a thermometer. It indicated his inability to hold the confidence of intelligent and influential men after he had had it. About this time, Lincoln wrote to General Hunter a personal letter which showed well how things were likely to go. "My dear sir, General Fremont needs assistance which is difficult to give him. He is losing the confidence of men near him, whose support any man in his position must have to be successful. His cardinal mistake is that he isolates himself and allows no one to see him, and by which he does not know what is going on in the very matter he is dealing with. He needs to have by his side a man of large experience. Will you not, for me, take that place?" It was Louis XV who exclaimed, "The state? I'm the state." The next move of Fremont can be compared only with that spirit of the French emperor. It was no less than a proclamation of emancipation. This was a civil act, while Fremont was an officer of military, not civil, authority. The act was unauthorized, the president was not even consulted. Even had it been a wise move, Fremont would have been without justification because it was entirely outside of his prerogatives. Even had he been the wisest man, he was not an autocrat and could not have thus transcended his powers. But this act was calculated to do much mischief. The duty of the hour was to save the Union. Fremont's part in that duty was to drive the rebels out of Missouri. Missouri was a slave state. It had not seceded, and it was important that it should not do so. The same was true of Kentucky and Maryland. It is easy to see upon reading Fremont's proclamation that it is the work not of a soldier, but of a politician, and a bungling politician at that. When this came to the knowledge of the president, he took prompt measures to counteract it in a way that would accomplish the greatest good with the least harm. He wrote to the general, "Allow me therefore to ask that you will, as of your own motion, modify that paragraph so as to conform to the first and fourth sections of the Act of Congress entitled, 'An Act to Confiscate Property Used for Insurrectionary Purposes,' approved August 6, 1861, and a copy of which act I herewith send you. This letter is written in a spirit of caution and not of censure." But Fremont was willing to override both President and Congress, and declined to make the necessary modifications. This placed him, with such influence as he had, in direct antagonism to the administration. that which ought to have been done by Fremont had to be done by Lincoln, upon whom was thrown the onus of whatever was objectionable in the matter. It did give him trouble. It alienated many of the extreme abolitionists, including even his old neighbor and friend, Oscar H. Browning. They seemed to think that Lincoln was now championing slavery. His enemies needed no alienation, but they made adroit use of this to stir up and increase discontent. So matters grew no better with Fremont, but much worse for 3 months. The words of Nicolai and Hay are none too strong. He had frittered away his opportunity for usefulness and fame, such an opportunity indeed as rarely comes. On October 21st, the President sent by special messenger the following letter to General Curtis at St. Louis. Dear Sir, on receipt of this, with the accompanying enclosures, you will take safe, certain, and suitable measures to have the enclosure addressed to Major General Fremont, delivered to him with all dispatch, subject to these conditions only. That if, when General Fremont shall be reached by the messenger, yourself or anyone sent by you, he shall then have, in personal command, fought and won a battle, or shall then be in the immediate presence of the enemy in expectation of a battle, it is not to be delivered but held for further orders. The enclosure mentioned was an order relieving General Fremont and placing Hunter temporarily in command. It is plain that the President expected that there would be difficulties in the way of delivering the order, that Fremont himself might prevent its delivery. General Curtis, who undertook its delivery, evidently expected the same thing, for he employed 3 different messengers who took 3 separate methods of trying to reach Fremont. The one who succeeded in delivering the order did so only because of his successful disguise, and when it was accomplished, Fremont's words and manner showed that he had expected to head off any such order. This incident reveals the peril which would have fallen to the American institutions had he been more successful in his aspirations to the presidency. Fremont had one more chance. He was placed in command of a corps in Virginia. There he disobeyed orders in a most atrocious manner, and by so doing permitted Jackson and his army to escape. He was superseded by Pope, but declining to serve under a junior officer, resigned. And that was the end of Fremont as a public man. The fact that he had ceased to be a force in American life was emphasized in 1864. The extreme abolitionists nominated him as a candidate for the presidency in opposition to Lincoln. But his following was so slight that he withdrew from the race and retired permanently to private life. Yet he was a man of splendid abilities of a certain sort. Had he practiced guerrilla warfare, had he had absolute and irresponsible command of a small body of picked men, with freedom to raid or do anything he pleased, he would have indeed been formidable. The terror which the rebel guerrilla General Morgan spread over wide territory would easily have been surpassed by Fremont. But guerrilla warfare was not permissible on the side of the government. The aim of the Confederates was destruction. The aim of the administration was construction. It is always easier and more spectacular to destroy than to construct. One trouble with Fremont was his narrowness of view. He could not work with others. If he wanted a thing in his particular department, it did not concern him that it might injure the cause as a whole. Another trouble was his conceit. He wanted to be the whole thing, President, Congress, General, and Judiciary. Had Lincoln not possessed the patience of Job, he could not have borne with him even so long. The kindness of the President's letter above quoted is eloquent testimony to his magnanimity. Chapter 29. Lincoln and McClellan. McClellan was a very different man from Fremont. Though he was as nearly as possible opposite in his characteristics, still it was not easier to get along with him. He was a man of brilliant talents, fine culture, and charming personality. Graduating from West Point in 1846, he went almost immediately into the Mexican War, where he earned his captaincy. He later wrote a manual of arms for use in the United States Army. He visited Europe as a member of the Commission of Officers to gather military information. His greatest genius was in engineering, a line in which he had no superior. He went to Illinois in 1857 as chief engineer of the Central Railway. The following year he became vice president and the year after that president of the St. Louis and Cincinnati Railway. At the outbreak of the war, this captain was by the governor of Ohio commissioned as Major General, and a few days later he received from Lincoln the commission of Major General in the United States Army. He was sent to West Virginia with orders to drive out the rebels. This he achieved in a brief time, and for it he received the thanks of Congress. He was, after the disaster at Bull Run, called to Washington and placed in command of that portion of the Army of the Potomac whose specific duty was the defense of the Capitol. He was rapidly promoted from one position to another until age and infirmity compelled the retirement of that grand old warrior Winfield Scott, whereupon he was made General-in-Chief of the United States Army. All this occurred in less than 4 months. 4 months ago, this young man of 35 years was an ex-captain. Today he is General-in-Chief, not of the largest army, but probably of the most intelligent army the world had ever seen. He would be almost more than human if such a sudden turn of the wheel of fortune did not also turn his head. It was Lincoln's habit to let his generals do their work in their own ways, only insisting that they should accomplish visible and tangible results. This method he followed with McClellan, developing it with great patience under trying circumstances. On this point there is no better witness than McClellan himself. To his wife he wrote, "They give me my way in everything, full swing and unbounded confidence." Later he expressed contempt for the president, who showed him too much deference. He was a universal favorite. He became known as the young Napoleon. He had the confidence of the country and the loyal devotion of the army and the unqualified support of the administration. Of him, great things were expected, and reasonably so. In the power of inspiring confidence and enthusiasm, he was second only to Napoleon. As an organizer and a drill master, he was superb. The army after Bull Run was as demoralized as an army could be. The recruits soon began to arrive from the north, every day bringing thousands of such into Washington. These required care, and they must be put into shape for effective service. This difficult task he accomplished in a way that fully met the public expectation and reflected great credit upon himself. In defense, he was a terrible fighter. That is to say, when he fought at all, for he fought only in defense, he fought well. A distinguished Confederate soldier said, "There was no Union general whom we so much dreaded as McClellan. He had, as we thought, no equal." And they declared that they could always tell when McClellan was in command by the way the men fought. An illustrious comment on this is the splendid fighting at Antietam. That was one of the greatest battles and one of the most magnificent victories of the war. It showed McClellan at his best. We know what the Army of the Potomac was previous to the accession of McClellan. Let us see what it was after his removal. McClellan was retired, says the Honorable Hugh McCullough, and what happened to the Army of the Potomac? Terrible slaughter under Burnside at Fredericksburg. Crushing defeat at Chancellorsville under Hooker. All this shows that McClellan narrowly missed the fame of being one of the greatest generals in history. But let us glance at another page in the ledger. His first act when in command at Cincinnati was to enter into an agreement with General Buckner that the state of Kentucky should be treated as neutral territory. That agreement put that state into the position of a foreign country, like England or China, when the very purpose of the war was to insist that the United States was one nation. This act was an usurpation of authority, and further it was diametrically wrong, even had he possessed the authority. His next notable act, one which has already been mentioned, was to issue a proclamation in defense of slavery, promising to assist the rebels to put down any attempt at insurrection by the slaves. This was wrong. His duty was to conquer the enemy. It was no more his duty to defend slavery than it was Fremont's to emancipate the slaves. The next development of McClellan was the hallucination, from which he never freed himself, that the enemy's numbers were from 5 to 10 times as great as they really were. "I am here," he wrote August 16, 1861, "in a terrible place. The enemy have from 3 to 4 times my force. The president, the old general, cannot or will not see the true state of affairs." At that time, the true state of affairs was that the enemy had from 1/3 to 1/2 his force. This is a fair specimen of the exaggeration of his fears. That is, McClellan's estimate was from 6 to 12 times too much. At Yorktown, he faced the Confederate Magruder, who commanded 11,000 all told. Of this number, 6,000 were spread along a line of 13 miles of defense across the peninsula, leaving 5,000 for battle. McClellan's imagination or fears magnified this into an enormous army. With his 58,000 effective troops, he industriously prepared for defense, and when the engineering work was accomplished, thought he had done a great act in defending his army. All the while, he was calling lustily for reinforcements from Washington. When Magruder was ready, he retired with his little army, and McClellan's opportunity was gone. At Antietam, he won a brilliant victory, but he failed to follow it up. There was a chance to annihilate the Confederate army and end the war. To do that was nearly as important as it had been to win the victory. To be sure, his troops were worn. But as compared with the shattered condition of the enemy, his army was ready for dress parade. So the enemy was allowed to cross the Potomac at leisure, reform, reorganize, and the war was needlessly prolonged. It was this neglect which, more than any other one thing, undermined the general confidence in McClellan. Later, at Second Bull Run, he left Pope to suffer. It was clearly his duty to reinforce Pope, but he only said that Pope had got himself into the fix and he must get out of it as he could. He seemed to forget that there never was a time when he was not calling for reinforcements himself. This wanton neglect was unsoldierly, inhuman. He also forgot that this method of punishing Pope inflicted severe punishment on the nation. His chronic call for reinforcements, were it not so serious, would make the motive of a comic opera. When he was in Washington, he wanted all the troops called in for the defense of the city. When he was in Virginia, he thought the troops which were left for the defense of the city ought to be sent to reinforce him. The city was safe enough. He telegraphed to Governor Dennison of Ohio to pay no attention to Rosecrans' request for troops. He thought that 20,000, with what could be raised in Kentucky and Tennessee, was enough for the Mississippi Valley, while he needed 273,000. When he was insisting that Washington should be stripped in order to furnish him with 50,000 additional men, the president asked what had become of his more than 160,000. And in his detailed reply, he gave the item of 38,500 absent on leave. Here was nearly the number of 50,000 which he asked for, if he would only call them in. Incidentally to all this were persistent discourtesies to the president. He would sit silent in the cabinet meetings, pretending to have secrets of great importance. Instead of calling on the president to report, he made it necessary for the president to call on him. At other times, he would keep the president waiting while he affected to be busy with subordinates. Once, indeed, he left the president waiting while he went to bed. All this Lincoln bore with his accustomed patience. He playfully said, when remonstrated with, that he would gladly hold McClellan's horse if he would only win the battles. This he failed to do. And when he was finally relieved, he had worn out the patience not only of the president, but of his army and of the entire country. One writer of the day said with much bitterness, but with substantial truth, that McClellan, with greater means at his command than Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon, or Wellington, had lost more men and means in his disasters than they in their victories. What were the defects of this remarkable man? In the first place, he believed in slavery. At this late date, it is difficult to realize the devotion which some men had for slavery as a divine institution before which they could kneel down and pray as if it was the very ark of God. McClellan was one such. And it is not improbable that he early had more than a suspicion that slavery was the real cause of all the trouble. This would in part account for his hesitation. Then there was a bitter personal hatred between him and Stanton. This led him to resent all suggestions and orders emanating from the War Department. It also made him suspicious of Stanton's associates, including the President. Then he seemed to lack the nerve for a pitched battle. He could do everything up to the point of action, but he could not act. This lack of nerve is a more common fact in men in all walks of life than is usually recognized. He was unconquerable in defense. he did not know the word aggressive. Had he possessed some of the nerve of Sheridan, Hooker, Sherman, or any one of a hundred others, he would have been one of the four great generals of history. But he could not be persuaded or forced to attack. His men might die of fever, but not in battle. So far as he is concerned, the Army of the Potomac might have been reorganizing, changing its base, and perfecting its defenses against the enemy to this day. A fatal defect was the endeavor to combine the military and the political. Few men have succeeded in this. There were Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon, but all came to an untimely end. The first met an early death in a foreign land. The second was assassinated. The third died a prisoner in exile. McClellan and Fremont, with all their splendid talents, made the fatal mistake. They forgot that for the time they were only military men. Grant was not a politician until after his military duties were ended. The conclusion of the relations between Lincoln and McClellan was not generally known until recently made public by Lincoln's intimate friend, Lehman. McClellan was nominated in 1864 for president by the Democrats. As Election Day approached, it became increasingly clear that McClellan had no chance whatever of being elected. But Lincoln wanted something more than and different from a re-election. His desires were for the welfare of the distracted country. He wanted peace, reconstruction, prosperity. A few days before the election, he sent a remarkable proposition through a common friend, Francis P. Blair, to McClellan. Mr. Blair was in hearty sympathy with the plan. The proposition set forth the hopelessness of McClellan's chances for the presidency, which he knew perfectly well. It was then suggested that McClellan withdraw from the contest and let the president be chosen by a united North, which would bring the war to a speedy close and stop the slaughter of men on both sides. The compensations for this concession were to be: McClellan was to be promoted immediately to be general of the army, his father-in-law Marcy was to be appointed major general, and a suitable recognition of the Democratic Party would be made in other appointments. At first blush, McClellan was in favor of the arrangement. It is probable that if left to himself, he would have acceded. The imagination can hardly grasp the fame that would have come to Little Mac and the blessings that would have come to the reunited country had this wise plan of Lincoln been accepted. But McClellan consulted with friends who advised against it. The matter was dropped, and that was the end of the history of McClellan. He had thrown away his last chance of success and fame. All that followed may be written in one brief sentence. On Election Day, he resigned from the army and was overwhelmingly defeated at the polls.
Thank you, everyone, for joining me tonight. Please remember to join General Ethan and I on Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for the 105th edition of the Patriot Hour, where we try to make sense out of all this nonsense. Also, I'd like to thank you for being here tonight, and to have a great weekend, and also to remind you, don't forget to have your pet Muzzy spayed or neutered. Good night, everyone.